Blog Talk Radio.
Today, indoor. If it's Tuesday, that means it's back to the live, coming back to the whatever part of our nation. This is back to the community, local friends, people of experts, pundits, inside, outside the Beltway. Joining us as always, every Tuesday, as he does on a regular basis, is our friend and parliamentarian. He is the Minority Council, he's a former Vice President of Government Affairs for National Broadcasting Company, and just all around great, great sage of politics here inside the Beltway. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how you doing?
I'm speechless.
Joining us as always, he is the lawyer that is certified to practice law in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He's the Vice President of Business Development and International Affairs for the Eurasia Center, and he is our international affairs expert around the table. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Dr. Winnie, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here. And Ni de Zhong, Ni de Ingwen, Dohan Hao.
One of these days, you're just going to have to teach me Mandarin, man, because this dog ain't on. I'll tell you that right now.
I wonder what he said.
For all I know, is CIA agents are going to just pull up here in front and just attack.
Any minute now.
Joining us, as always, he is the former staffer with the Department of Homeland Security's White House Liaison's Office. He is the graduate student up at American University. He is our executive director of the First Congress Society and the executive producer of this show. It is Mr. Perry Blasting. Perry, welcome.
Justin, thanks for having me.
Now, I know you guys are going to be wondering, wait a minute, we're missing somebody. Well, Congressman Al Swift, former 8-term representative of Washington's 2nd Congressional District, is out of the country on assignment, and by out of the country on assignment, I mean he's on vacation. Al, if you're listening, have a great time. Buenas tardes, mi amigo. And that might give you guys an idea of where he might be. I will tell you right now, there's a lot of stuff going on right now as we are here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics. We are watching things develop here inside the Capitol as they are now voting to possibly divert a government shutdown of the federal government. So, before we get started, I want to give you our call-in numbers. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have any questions for our roundtable, or just have general political statements that you'd like to make to us, please, by all means, join us. The number here is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. You can also log on to firstcongress.org and listen to us live streaming audio on Blog Talk Radio. So, they're voting. They're voting to try and stop a government shutdown here in Congress. Last time we saw, there were a lot of nay votes on that screen coming out of C-SPAN. Bob, just for those laymen, what is the vote today? What is it going to do?
The final vote today will be a vote on a resolution that would extend the operation of the federal government and the funding thereof from the 4th of this month, I believe, through the 18th. It's a 2-week extension.
Of the current continuing resolution.
Of the resolution. But it is not the resolution that has been in place before, because this resolution, in addition to extending the funding of the government for 2 weeks, also would cut $4 billion out of the budget. Now, these are cuts that the Democrats have agreed to generally in the Senate, and I think also in the House. These are cuts that the president himself was going to make in his budget.
Right.
So they have just these $4 billion has been moved into this resolution, and I think probably in order to continue the view that the Tea Party folks have, that they want any resolution to, if they're going to vote for it, continuing or otherwise, to begin the process of cutting the budget back.
So is this vote, Bob, a formality? Is this a guarantee go through? And we're going to avert a shutdown? Or, I mean, I saw a lot of nay votes on there.
Well, what the nay votes for, that what you saw there was a motion to recommit the resolution.
Oh, okay.
And there were a lot of votes there not to recommit it. A lot of them were Republicans. They don't want to recommit the resolution. They want to adopt the resolution because it does cut something out of the budget.
What are the possible ramifications of them voting against the current resolution as it stands?
Well, if the resolution fails and there is no progress between now and the 4th of March, the government fundamentally begins a shutdown process.
So is today the absolute last-ditch effort of preventing a government shutdown?
No.
Or are there other actions in play?
I believe the Senate has not yet voted on the resolution. The House is going first. So it'll have to go back to the Senate.
Is the Senate's obviously got to be watching this very, very carefully.
Absolutely, and I'm sure that given the fact that it was their proposal that has been adopted, the idea of 2 weeks, which is what the House wanted, and they have added $4 billion in cuts, which I'm sure the Tea Party people like, and the Senate Democrats are prepared to accept. It seems to me that we are likely to have success in this effort either today or tomorrow in the Senate.
So let's say that we get success, we avert the government shutdown for at least 2 weeks. Is there anything that you foresee in your experience that could possibly put a speed bump on this whole process over the next 2 weeks? Who are going to be some of the pushers in this?
Well, it's always possible that something will go wrong. I can think of several things. I can think of the fact that the resolution could be amended in the House if it were permitted. I'm not sure what the rules are. I haven't seen the technicals of it. But if they could amend it and the Tea Party people wish to go farther than $4 billion, I suspect the Senate would possibly balk at that.
What, Ralph, government shutdown is going to affect everybody here domestically, but from an international aspect, how is this going to affect the way we're conducting? I mean, we've got a lot of foreign affairs issues going on right now. How is this going to affect the view of our government shutdown? How is it going to be viewed internationally, particularly in the Far East?
Well, I think people are very concerned. They can't understand why the U.S. can't get their financial system in order. And if we reach a point where we have to shut the government down, we're going to lose a lot of international prestige and respect among our allies and among people that don't think very highly of us. For the simple reason that we should be able to come together and pass a budget and get things rolling.
Well, this now begs the question. I mean, you know, we had a government shutdown in 95, and in that instance, it happened twice. They did it. Government shut down for 3 days. They had a resolution that expanded 2 weeks, and then they had another shutdown for 2 days after that. Did that government shutdown truly affect the way that we were viewed internationally, or is it just a hiccup and then eventually we'll get back to the prestige that everybody...
Well, back then, the budget really wasn't a big issue. I mean, we did not have foreign countries lecturing us on fiscal accountability and responsibility. We were not going over to China and asking them to buy more treasury bonds. It was simply a pure political issue, and most international pundits and observers viewed it that way.
How, Bob, when we look at the government shutdown and we look at the messaging that's got to come out from a lot of the seated members of Congress, how do they, in fact, get this message out? What is the message that they get out to their people?
Well, if you are a Tea Party member of the House, your message is we're doing what we said we would do, but we have an opportunity to cut. Even in a continuing resolution of only 2 weeks, we are cutting. I think that's a positive message from their standpoint. I think that for others, the Democrats, let's say, I think the Democrat message is we're continuing to work to get a budget done. We continue to negotiate with the Republicans, and we are doing everything we can to see to it that we get a budget as soon as possible so the government will not be shut down and the continuing flow of federal funds to various programs and agencies will continue.
I gotta make an observation. I mean, nobody's gonna win in this aspect. We've said this before several times on this show. But the only one who truly wins, especially with the current setup of Congress, the only one who's gonna gain any momentum from this is the White House, is the president himself. We saw it in 95. We saw previously back in the 80s when this happened again. The White House is the one that always comes up on top. I've got to say that, you know, we're now entering a point where the government shutdown has become more political than ideological. It is more a matter of who can spin this the best. And in this case, the Tea Party is just making an absolute fundamental push ahead on spinning this their way and getting the most mileage out of this car.
Well, let me put it this way. If we have success, and if this resolution and a final resolution going forward, which also cuts budget money from this fiscal year, is adopted, the Tea Party can certainly claim some success. If, on the other hand, there is a failure of a resolution, and we do go into even a short stoppage, I think that the White House will have an advantage because the government will have closed down. They will say they have done all they can to keep it going, and the Republican Tea Parties and others are just outrageously trying to close the government down and damage a whole lot of people around the country who depend on various federal programs.
And I don't think the Tea Party has come up with a plan that what happens when the government shuts down, they can really sell to their constituents.
Well, we've said this before, and it continues to be. And by the way, I'm sorry if I'm distracted. Right outside Shelley's back room in the middle of downtown Washington, D.C. is a Formula One race car that we've seen drive around several times. It's something you just don't see every day in downtown Washington, D.C. And he's at a stoplight, so you got to give him credit for obeying the traffic rule here in the district. Going back to the topic, folks, you will see all kinds of stuff here in Washington, D.C. You got to come visit if you get a chance. Really, yeah, check that out. Who's sponsoring that?
Honda.
The National Guard and Honda. Interesting. And there's a park policeman right behind him. Even better. When we talk about the government shutdown, Bob, I am not familiar with the bill as it stands currently. The $4 billion, what are some examples of the $4 billion that are going to be cut out of this?
Quite frankly, I don't know. I don't know what they're cutting out, but it's what the president agreed. These are programs the president has agreed to cut in his budget that has been submitted. So they're just being removed from the potential 2012 budget cycle to move it into this budget cycle in order to get some money that the Democrats are willing to see go away, and Republicans are looking for something to cut.
How does this affect the overall budget process? I mean, we are deep in the 2011 fiscal year, and we're still operating without a budget. We're now getting into, the president just introduced his presidential budget request within the past 2 weeks, which we talked about on previous shows. How is this going to affect the overall budget process? You've got a lot of people that are concerned about the current fiscal year. Are they going to lose momentum as they try and negotiate deals for the upcoming fiscal year in 2012?
If the continuing resolution efforts that are underway right now are successful, there will be very little impact. The problem will go away. If it is not successful, we will continue to have serious problems in this cycle, and it will be only more difficult when the 2012 budget resolutions begin to come out of the Congress in the next few months. that we will be able to get that done as well. So it's very, very important that they find a solution as quickly as possible to the budget problems for this fiscal year, which is approximately half over.
And people really need to...
Well, we're going to take a break here. Looks like right now the house is... We got a 2-week work on the shutdown, so now it's not going to go... Stay with us. Well, that's the other thing that Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. With us, as always, is the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie. Congressman Al Swift is off vacationing somewhere under a palm tree enjoying margaritas, wherever he may be. God, that's a picture. Bob, you were talking about during the break, before we came back on air, that when this happened back in 95... Tell me about what happened back in 95, and how does that compare to what's happened today?
Well, in 95, the Republicans were in control of the House and the Senate. And the House of Representatives, led by Speaker Gingrich, very much wanted to call the president's bluff, so to speak. They were prepared to shut the government down. Senator Dole, who was at that point the... Majority leader of the Senate, was not as comfortable with the idea, but basically he was overruled, and the government did shut down. And I think the Republicans...
Who drove that back then? Was that in fact Speaker Gingrich at the time?
Yes. Gingrich and the leadership in the House.
Okay.
Not just himself, but the leadership in the House. But what happened was that when something like this happens, when a major crisis happens... You may be the Speaker, or you may be the Majority Leader of the Senate, but your pulpit is not nearly as bully as that of the president in the White House, whichever party he is in. And the fact of the matter is, Mr. Clinton was certainly able to out-talk Mr. Gingrich and Mr. Dole about the value of or the danger of a shutdown of the government. And it was one of the problems that that caused Republicans to have some. They had some real problems after that, and they lost some of their clout and they lost some of their ability to lead because they tried to do something, they did it, and it didn't work. It backfired.
Right. Was a trap set for Gingrich by the Democrats?
No, the trap. Okay. There was no trap set. He wandered into it with eyes wide open.
Now, obviously, to get a little bit of First Congress Society topics up on this subject, there's been a lot. We haven't seen as much of the rhetoric, I guess, regarding this government shutdown, but we've been seeing a really strong push from the Tea Party on this. The question I have is the Tea Party, is this going to backfire on the Tea Party? Is this, in fact, a message that they're pushing as far as, you know, we'll shut down the government before we have indiscretionary spending like drunk sailors? Is this going to be a problem for the Tea Party in the future, or how are they going to come out of this?
Well, right now, I think if I were a member of the Tea Party, and I am going to assume that the resolution, which I understand cuts some $4 billion out of the budget, cuts that the president has already approved in his budget, so they just moved it forward. So the Democrats in the Senate ought to be able to vote for this resolution, and as well as the House Republicans. So it's going to pass. And I don't think there's going to be any spillover at all. I think, quite frankly, we'll be able to move forward. And I think the Tea Party people can say, we came to Washington. You know, we want to cut some. We wanted to make some cuts. This is a cut we're making, and we'll have another chance, another 2 weeks, when another continuing resolution has to come up, to do some more if we need to.
Will they make more cuts to the point where it could cause a shutdown?
I have no idea. I don't know what the strategy will be at this point. I think that's probably something that will be, assuming the Senate moves tomorrow and the continuing resolution for the next 2 weeks is in fact adopted, I would expect that almost immediately there'll be negotiations begin, both in the Senate among the members and in the House among the members.
Ralph,
I think the Tea Party, they're walking a tightrope, because the American people have said, we want an end to partisan bickering, we want people to come together to solve problems. At the same time, the American people want drastic budget cuts. So the Tea Party has to recognize both sides. They cannot push for a total government shutdown without any kind of plan for the American people.
We still, to this day, we said it last week, yeah. We said it 2 weeks ago, we still have not seen a legitimate spending plan put forward by anybody other than the presidential budget request that he submitted last year this time.
Absolutely.
We have not seen anybody come up with any solid ideas on exactly how to get this current fiscal crisis in check. And that's got to be something that's got to be disturbing to not only the majority in the House, but the White House as well. There's no message coming.
And the Tea Party, different Tea Party groups have different ideas about what they want to cut. So there is no consensus among the Tea Party.
Have we seen, I mean, you would think that something like this would consolidate the Tea Party in their message. It's done just the opposite, I think. Am I not seeing that correctly?
Well, recall that a couple of weeks ago, the Budget Committee in the House of Representatives, led by Paul Ryan, adopted a budget resolution for this year, calling for $32 billion in cuts, I think. And in the Republican conference that was looking at what was going on, the conference said, in effect, led by the Tea Party, that we want more cuts. And you may recall that Republicans then adopted a resolution of a continuing resolution that cut $62 billion, I believe. That resolution went over to the Senate and didn't go anywhere. It passed the House, didn't go anywhere in the Senate. And that's when the negotiations on this current two-week, $4 billion cut resolution, which we have just voted on in the House, came to be. So there, at least from the standpoint of the House Republican Conference, there is a template out there of what to cut. There's $62 billion. It exists.
Theoretically has agreed to.
Well, at least the majority of the Republicans in the House have agreed to it. Certainly the Democrats in the House voted against it, and the Senate Democrats would not bring it up. It in fact said, no, we're going to send another one back, a two-weeker that only has $4 billion in the cut. And that's the one the House has just agreed to. So what that means, I don't know whether the Tea Party has now decided that the $62 billion original resolution that they were recommending be brought up again, or whether they're going to do something else at the end of the next 2 weeks. But we're going to debate this whole issue continuously for the next 2 weeks.
You know, the funny thing I see about this is everybody, you know, we're talking about a possible government shutdown, but economically, we see February was the second month in a row where we saw solid gains in the stock market. We've seen job numbers that have been fairly optimistic, arguably. But yet, when we talk about the fiscal crisis, there's certain indicators that are out there that are saying, you know what, maybe we are in a recovery right now. Maybe we have flattened out and now we're back on the upslide. Why, after seeing those economic indicators, why has Congress not taken those measures into account in some of the decisions they're making today on the Hill?
Well, I mean, just in the last 10 days, we have seen oil go up over $100 a barrel. I don't know about you, but I gassed my car up this morning, and it has gone in a week from 329 to 371.
Right.
So that's a pretty scary number. But it shouldn't affect the economy that much. But you take a look at silver and gold are moving up rapidly because commodities move up when people think there's going to be a problem and slow the economy down again. And obviously, if oil continues to go up, it's not going to be good for the economy.
And we're going to talk about that here a little bit later in the show, or the oil issue and what's happening in the Middle East. Last 2 minutes of this segment before we go to break again, question comes up is when we see the vote being taken by the House as they've already passed the resolution for the 2 week stay of government shutdown. When we see all this going down, and we see everybody in play, who are going to be the big winners in this, Bob?
Well, I'm almost afraid to venture a guess. The president, again, has the best pulpit to speak. So if things go badly with respect to cuts he doesn't like and too much cutting, he'll be able to point to specific cuts that the Tea Party and the Republicans have pushed. And for, you know, everybody who says, I'd like to see the budget cut, there's somebody whose program is being cut, and they don't like it. So we're going to see one of the reasons we have yet to see a lot of people giving very specifics about what they want to cut is because they don't want to have the country rise up and say, cut the guy behind the tree.
Right.
You know, the old line.
Wow.
You
know, wow. Very poetic. Yeah. Bob, I got to tell you.
Well, that comes from a great Senator Huey Long. But Earl Long. But remember, we're going to have cuts. The president's going to be opposed to some of them. People are going to be opposed to some of them, and anybody who voted for them is going to have to go back home and say, the reason I voted for them is because the budget is so out of whack, and I felt that we all had to give a little. But some people may not like that, and if they don't like it, they're going to be unhappy with their congresspeople.
And I think Boehner has done a fairly good job of giving the Tea Party members in his caucus an opportunity to draft amendments and to speak out about the cuts that they would like to see in the budget. So they're being given a voice within the Republican Party. They go back and say, look, I've tried to work to get these cuts.
Alright, well, when we come back in our next segment, we're going to be talking about the budget crisis in the state, from Capitol Hill to State Hill. Apparently, there's a lot of stuff happening in Wisconsin, a lot of stuff happening in Ohio, Illinois, Indiana. I am again having some issues. This is Back to Politics live from Johnny's Back Room, 1330 F Street, live on Block Talk Radio. Stay with us. Is off doing Perry type stuff. Al Swift out on assignment, and I'm your host, JT Russell. If you'd like to join our conversation, please feel free to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477. We'll take all questions, and any subject you'd like to bring up is open fodder for our political roundtable. But before the break, we were talking about bringing up the subject about what's happening out in the States. I got to tell you something. Wisconsin becomes more and more of a mess as every day passes. We still have a collective group of legislators in Wisconsin that are now south of the border in Illinois. We're starting to see some movement in some budgetary movement in the legislature in Indiana. Ohio has been getting some press lately on some of the cuts that they're making. But the bottom line here is one of the subjects we've seen is that in this entire crisis, particularly in Wisconsin and Governor Walker, he has really made, or is really trying to make rather, a name for himself in the national political scene by taking a stump on the budget crisis in his state. For no other reason, this has now become, in my opinion, labor busting. This is union busting versus a tough stance on budgetary concerns. Bob, what do you think? Is he really making a stance on fiscal concerns, or is this truly an issue where he is just busting the unions and trying to make Wisconsin a right-to-work state?
Well, I don't know that he's trying to make it a right-to-work state, but the unions have already said that they would be willing to negotiate on pension questions and pay questions. So from the standpoint of the money issues that the state of Wisconsin is trying to solve, there's already an ability to solve that problem and reach an agreement. Going beyond that, I mean, I don't know that his goal is to bust the union. But he has certainly got himself in a situation where it appears that his interest, while it may be to help get the financial part of the state, problems of the state, repaired to some extent, he has gone he has taken the opportunity also to try to do some limiting of the ability of the unions to be as strong as they are in that state. Now, I don't know how far he wants to go. I do know one thing, that doing what he's doing and letting the union say he's union busting is not doing the governor any good. He's losing support.
But here's the funny thing about it is, you have every major union in the state, and we saw it in New Jersey. We're now seeing it in Wisconsin. Everybody has gone up to the governor's mansion and said, look, this is our state. The fiscal well-being of our state directly affects us. We're willing to make some sacrifices, and they've made that position known. And yet Governor Walker has still not budged on the collective bargaining issue.
Well, you've sort of taken the belief that you have a ballooning deficit in the budget that you can't touch because of collective bargaining, instead of trying to work with the unions now at this point.
All right. Look, everybody who's been listening to the show for a while knows I am a Republican. I'm a very moderate Republican. I will tell you that there are unions that I do think very fondly of. There are other unions that I think just are in it for the political aspects versus representing the best interests of their members. But in total, to try and knock out collective bargaining to me as a budget issue is a red herring. It doesn't exist. There is no administrative load that is so great that it is going to directly affect the budget of each individual state if they have collective bargaining. That's the bottom line here.
And Walker now has energized the whole labor movement.
Of course he has. But you know, when we sit here and we look at what's happening out in Wisconsin, you know, Bob, you and I were talking before the show. He's saying that, you know, it is not the responsibility of the state to collect union dues, and you agree with him.
Yeah, I do. I don't think that it's really appropriate, if you will, for the state to be collecting the dues from the union, from the employees, and then giving them and then sending it on to the union. Now, if companies want to do that and negotiate it, I would have no problem with that. That's legitimate. But I think a governmental entity, which is supposed to be responsible to its citizens and not just a small group, is in effect here assisting the unions when it should be a union responsibility to collect their dues from the
citizens.
I see no problem with the union doing it, and I don't think they have any trouble doing it. But it seems to me that it isn't the state's responsibility to collect their dues.
But Bob, what is the difference between if you're going to tell the state administrative functionalities, if you're going to tell the state government, hey, it is not your responsibility to collect dues and distribute it out to the locals, there's a hypocrisy built into that argument, because they do the same thing with health insurance. And they take money out of their checks and they give it to the private health care insurance, and they're making money. We're talking about giving to a nonprofit. I mean, if you want to go so far, is it the role of the federal government to take money out during the combined federal campaign? Do we start saying, hey, federal government, don't take out money to give to United Way, American Red Cross, or whichever federal employees have the election to do?
What about basic fundamental right of giving the people a choice of whether they want to join the union or not, rather than be entering into a profession and having to join a union?
Yeah, but the issue that Scott Walker's bringing up, or that Governor Walker's bringing up, rather, that issue is not to join or not to join. This is not an open vote issue. This is an issue to truly bust up collective bargaining. Now, as a Republican, you know, I tend to side with management in a lot of aspects, but let's be real. Collective bargaining has had a purpose inside the way that our governments run. And quite frankly, the idea of, and again, with the black Formula One sports car. We got people taking pictures.
Oh boy, this is something to see.
The reality still dictates is, you cannot tell me that collective bargaining is such an administrative burden that it's going to save the financial future of the state of Wisconsin or any state. It has served a purpose. Collective bargaining and the unions have created a strong, healthy middle class. They have a purpose. Why take away the voice of those who serve the people of the state of Wisconsin for what amounts to a political dog and pony show?
And what Walker should be doing is he should be pushing the issue of choice about whether people want to join a union or not, not trying to end collective bargaining entirely.
It is still their choice. It is still their choice. But collective bargaining is not a choice matter. Collective bargaining is every member of the union saying, look, we're trying to represent ourselves and get the best, most fair deal for our people as they continue to serve the citizens of their individual state. That's the bottom line here. I think this is absolute insanity, and I think it'll backfire. It's already brought back the union to a point where they haven't seen this kind of success in years. And now you're going to probably see more membership, stronger unions, and they're going to hold firm on collective bargaining.
And they're going to push for Walker's recall.
I don't know if it'll go that far. I think that's speculation. But I will tell you. I mean, like, make no mistake about it. The unions have a voting block.
Absolutely.
They are going to get their message heard, and it's going to be painful if you're on the other side. I'm not saying that they're always right. I can tell you right now, what the American Federation of Teachers did in New Jersey is absolutely reprehensible. Governor Christie, every union, whether it's FOP or PBA, the IAFF for the firefighters, whether it's the Teamsters, no matter who it was, every union went to Governor Christie and said, we'll make the sacrifices, we'll pay a little bit more. Everybody except the American Federation of Teachers went to bat for the state of New Jersey. We're seeing the exact same powers in play in Wisconsin. It is absolutely just reprehensible is the only word I can think
about.
Well,
it's reaching a point where Governor Walker is either going to have to negotiate with the unions or he's going to have to do what Reagan did and just fire everybody.
And that's just not going to fly. Bob, you're being really quiet on this subject, which is different for you.
I think that the governor is pushing farther than he could and should. But I think it's going to be difficult because I don't think he's going to win this fight if he goes beyond what he already has got, which is an agreement on wages and pensions and health care. So as far as that goes, he's won his money fight, and I don't think he can win a fight that the unions can. All they have to do is point a finger at him and say you're a union buster. You know, it's not a question of, at that point, it becomes less a question of yes or no or right or wrong. It becomes an emotional, ideological appeal, and it'll win.
Well, I mean, but then again, Reagan came out of the PATCO situation looking like a rock star at a time when unions arguably weren't at their finest hour. Can Walker do the same thing that Reagan did back in the 80s?
I doubt it.
Ralph?
I think there would be severe repercussions. What I think is most likely is they're going to try and recall these Democratic legislators that have fled the state. That's the more likely scenario.
Which is another issue because the unions have already come up. They've already said that they're willing to bargain. They're willing to deal. And yet we still see members of the state legislature hanging out in northern Illinois. At some point, they're going to have to say, we've got to govern. How does this continue on? I mean, at some point, there's got to be ramifications against those individual legislators that are hanging out in Illinois.
The fact of the matter is, they are not—they're not meeting their responsibilities as legislators. It's clear and simple. They've got to come back.
And they're collecting a paycheck for Christ's sake.
That's true.
They're doing not—they're doing nothing.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
true. That's really despicable.
Well, let's talk about the financial crisis when we come back from the break. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. ¶¶ But it's getting tougher and tougher to navigate around this town without a playbook. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. I am your moderator and host, J.T. Russell. With me, as always, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, our executive producer, Perry Blasting, somewhere out in the hinterlands of the smoking crust.
I'm standing right behind you.
Well, we haven't heard from you all day. This is unusual for you, Perry.
You know, I'll be honest, the budget is... and unions are not areas that I am so familiar with. When we start talking about Libya, I'll jump in.
Which, by the way, brings us up to our top of the hour subject. We'll be talking about what's happening out in the Middle East and some of the oil issues that have been going on. Because I'm sure as everybody's filling up their car knows, oil has gone up, and we'll talk about that here shortly. Finishing up the hour, talking about the fiscal crisis, Bobby, you're a native of Ohio. You still have strong ties to what's going on there in Ohio. Ohio is traditionally a hardcore blue-collar Rust Belt state. How does what's happening in Wisconsin affect what's going on in your state? And are we going to see similar actions in Ohio that we're seeing in Madison?
I suspect that we're not going to have the same quite as heated debate because I think that Governor Kasich, recently elected, just like the governor, just like Mr. Walker in Wisconsin, he has seen what's happened up there in Wisconsin. I am sure that the union structure in Ohio is at least as strong, if not stronger, than it is in Wisconsin because there's more manufacturing in Ohio than there is in Wisconsin, I suspect. So I would think that he'll be a little more careful. Because he is he's a pretty smart guy. He's a pretty savvy guy. He spent a decade in the House of Representatives. He understands the politics of unions, and he understands their need and what they've got to do. And I would expect he'd try to be a little more cautious in the scope of his interest in his demand.
I'll tell you, we're seeing some really rogue decisions being made by some of this new freshman class of governors. We're seeing it with Governor Walker. Governor Kasich's kind of been behind the scenes, kind of taking an eye of what's happening there. But we see Governor Rick Scott down in Florida. Governor Scott just announced that he's turning down $2.4 billion for high-speed rail initiatives, which I think is absolutely insane. You want to talk about creating jobs. You want to talk about something that's going to bring benefit economically to the state. High-speed rail is definitely one of those items, and he's turning it down against the will of his Republican representatives here in Washington. What's going on with
That's not the only. There are several other governors who have turned down money for high-speed rail, and I think the reason it is because there is no high-speed passenger rail in this country that is breaking even. Now, it's okay if you're going to get some money from the government to build it, but they're not going to get any money. The way things are now, they're not going to get any money that isn't already committed for maintenance or support or anything else, or to reduce their debt, pay off their debt. And I think a lot of states are worried as hell that they're going to have this albatross around their neck. They're going to get stuck with a bill that, on a continuing basis, that is just not going to be financially sound.
But it's not like this country's not gone through issues of subsidized rail. Look at Amtrak.
Yeah, and it's losing money, and they all see that.
Amtrak still has its most profitable area here in the Northeast, which is a model for, the Northeast Corridor. Air traffic is completely slowed down. It is just a horrible endeavor to try and get through air traffic going up between Washington and New York, or Washington and Boston, Boston, New York. So we've seen an uptick in what we've seen in high-speed rail in the Acela, the Northeast Regional. But we also look at countries like China, for example, Ralph, where they've got high-speed rail. It's government-subsidized, but the government actually makes pretty decent money off of the revenue generated by passengers on high-speed rail. What are the Chinese doing that we're not seeing?
Well, they put together a stimulus package, and billions of dollars was poured into infrastructure development to penetrate into areas that were previously underdeveloped and create new sectors of business opportunity. So they've made a huge commitment in establishing power grids, setting up high-speed rail, and this is really revolutionizing their own country.
But, it's almost, oh, I'm sorry, Perry, you had a thought.
Well, one of the other things, for instance, that China does right that we don't is China has true high-speed rail. Mm-hmm. What you mentioned with us with the cell on the Northeast Corridor is not a true high-speed rail because it's only operating at a fraction of the speed that high-speed rail does. The reason is, right now it shares track with the Amtrak Regional. What that does is there's not a lot of straight track, there's a lot of turns, and when you go into a turn, you have to slow down or the train tips over.
Right.
And right now, with going back to why they're losing money, is because for you and I to buy a ticket on a Acela, let's say from Washington, D.C. to New York, it's a substantial amount of money more than a normal ticket, but it's not that much quicker. The reason is it still has to travel on the same track as the non-high-speed rail, but it slows down every time it gets to a turn. So until the day comes when we have dedicated lines that can operate like China does, they're not going to get people to spend the extra money and do it.
But you're actually feeding into the argument then that says, look, when we talk about high-speed rail or any, I mean, let's be honest, America has a critical infrastructure problem.
Right. Yes, they do.
We don't have the type of highways that we should as a first world power. We don't have the rail system that would be expected of a first world power. Yet the federal government's saying, look, it's now time for the American infrastructure to come back to its glory days of the early 1900s. So if that money is being authorized, even in a time of budget cuts, why, as a governor, would you say, no, thank you? That's my question to the table.
Well, the answer is that the program provides some money for construction, but it provides no money for anything else. No maintenance, no improvements, nothing down the road. Now, we're in so much trouble financially, this is not a need. This is not a need. This is something you don't have to have. You just would like to have.
And in effect, what happens is you end up raising taxes to pay for it.
You'd have to.
Even if we were to go to a privatized method of O&M, we see it here in the regional rails. Amtrak runs the VRE, or actually Amtrak ran the VRE, but it's gone to a private company out of France. You look, Amtrak still runs the MARTrain. For those of you who are outside the Beltway, these are the regional rail systems that feed into and feed out to communities around Washington, D.C.
Too much bureaucratic red tape. You have union, you have environmental concerns to deal with, and this all means something like high-speed rail is going to take time.
If we're $14.3 trillion in deficit now,
yes.
Why would we be spending several hundred billion dollars to build railroads? Why don't we improve the highway system, which would be a lot better way to spend the money?
We've already seen that in the Recovery Act, and that's already proven it's created jobs.
That's right. And why don't we do, if we're going to spend that kind of money, if we're going to spend that kind of money on infrastructure, I'd sure rather have us spend it on highways and bridges than I would on trains. Let's assume for the purpose of we build it and we're going to try to give it to somebody private. Look at the Greenway outside of Washington, which is a highway which was built by public money and it was sold to private investors. The price of using the Greenway in the last 4 years has what? Doubled or tripled?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. The fact of the matter is it still is not making money. That's why they keep raising the prices. So I don't see why a state would say, okay, we're going to go for a railroad, which we don't know if it'll be successful. We know we're going to have to finance it. Once it's built, we got to put money into the building. Feds will put a lot of money in too, but we got to do all the maintenance, all the improvements, all the rest of it is going to be stuck for
but
us.
But you don't think that a company, take for example CSX or Burlington Northern, wouldn't take the opportunity to sit there and say, look, in key critical areas, look at Chicago, look at what's happening on the West Coast, the California corridor, all the way up to Seattle, the Florida Peninsula, the I-4 corridor down to Miami up to Jacksonville. You don't think there's a company out there that doesn't see the financial value of a privatized rail system that could make money based on subsidized infrastructure build-out?
Well, the railroads haven't done it. When they were able to do it, they didn't do it. They got out of the passenger business and stayed in the freight business. They didn't want to do it. They were the experts, and they didn't do it.
But that was also at a time when air travel wasn't as prominent as it was. It's also at a time when, you know, we've got an antiquated air traffic control system that isn't funded completely, but they're putting money into NextGen out of FAA. We're seeing a lot of movement to increase our transportation infrastructure, but the one area we don't see and the one area that has demand, again, with the black Formula One race car.
What this is telling us is the black Formula race car is telling us, fix the highways and the bridges.
That's great. All right, that's going to close out. Ralph, you got the last word.
You have to make the national commitment to do this. A country like China can go ahead and set up an elaborate freeway system. When they want to do something, it just gets done. They don't have to worry about environmental concerns, OSHA, unions. If something needs to get built, it gets built, and they pay for it through tolls.
Well, we're coming up on the top of the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about some international affairs items, Ralph, that's got definite domestic implications. We're going to talk about what's happening out in the Mideast. We're going to talk about what's happening with the price of oil and how it's tied to the uncertainty and the instability happening out in the Middle East. But for those of you who are joining us, please, we invite you to call in. The number is 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The place to be, Bob.
No kidding. This is the place to be.
It's our second hour here at Blog Talk Radio on Backroom Politics. Joining me as always, he is the former Minority Counsel in the House of Representatives under Gerald R. Ford, former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation, and General Parliamentarian for the First Congress Society. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, thanks for joining us as always.
Wouldn't miss it.
And joining us also, he is the attorney licensed to practice in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is the Vice President of Business Development for the Eurasia Center and our international affairs expert, which our next segment is going to play into. But he is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, thanks for staying with us.
Glad to be here.
He is our executive producer of Backroom Politics. He is the executive director of the First Congress Society. He is the former staffer at the White House Liaison's Office with the Department of Homeland Security. And he is the one who keeps us in line. He is Perry Blasting. Perry, thanks for staying with us.
Of course, sir.
And I'm your host, J.T. Russell. I will tell you right now, when we stopped talking, we had a really viable discussion about high-speed rail. Kind of got off a little bit off topic, but it ties into our infrastructure problems. But I want to turn the table a little bit and look at what's happening out in the Middle East. It's having severe domestic ramifications. The instability of the governments. Every time we turn around, there's another government going down. We saw Hosni Mubarak 2 weeks ago depart his leadership role as head of state in Egypt. We've seen some violent protests in Bahrain, which is, quite frankly, tends to be one of the more peaceful nations in the Middle East. We're seeing it in Jordan. King Abdullah is really having a problem trying to keep everything in check in Jordan. And the big one right now, Tunisia, the head of state in Tunisia has resigned. But the big one that's got everybody's attention right now, that's got everybody on edge, is Libya. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, after many, many decades of whether you want to call it dictatorial leadership, whether you want to just call it, call it what you will, Libya is in a state of chaos, and it is going to have effects on everything from our foreign policy to the way we buy gas. Ralph, can you give us a little bit of a take on what the latest is coming out of Libya?
Sure. As we know, thousands are fleeing Libya, and it's causing a great humanitarian crisis. Libyan diplomats are defecting to the opposition. Libya now has recently been kicked out of the UN Human Rights Security Council. That's a very positive step. There are five things that the U.S. should be encouraging NATO to do. They need to enforce the no-fly and no-tank zone. We need to freeze Libyan government assets in the U.S. and Europe.
Which they've done.
We need to consider temporarily halting the importation of Libyan oil into the U.S. and Europe. We need to provide humanitarian aid to the Libyan people as quickly as possible. And we also need to make a clear statement that Gaddafi and his officers, who are ordering and trying to participate in massacres of civilians, that they're going to be held accountable for war crimes under international law.
Well,
this also applies to the mercenaries that Gaddafi has hired
to
come in.
You've got a lot of topics that we're going to cover here in our second hour, but right now what we're seeing is developing stories coming out of Tripoli. The UN High Commission on Refugees has declared the situation in Libya as a true humanitarian crisis.
Absolutely.
The number right now is 150,000 have now fled towards the Tunisian border, and they're not exactly in full stability yet. But the Tunisian government's got the added impact of having 150,000 Libyans now going to their border. For the High Commission on Refugees to come out and say this is a crisis, that's got to get everybody's attention, Ralph.
Well, I think the U.S. and Europe have a moral interest in bringing an end to the violence and to the murderous Gaddafi regime. This is not a time for any delay or indecisiveness. We have to support the people of Libya and the Middle East in their time of opportunity and also peril.
Well, for those of you who are just joining us and would like to call in and talk about the situation in the Middle East or any topic, please feel free to call in. The number here is 619-638-8477. Again, 619-638-8477 is the call-in number to get on Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room. Bob, this has got to give you pause. You've seen a lot of things happening. You've been in Washington a long time. This has got to be something that's got your attention as far as being a little bit nervous as we deal with the Libyan situation.
Well, this situation is different than Tunisia, and it's different than Egypt. Here you have the head of state, apparently, from all the reports we've seen, he has brought mercenaries in, and he's got them shooting his own people. It's something that is absolutely stunning in the level to which he will stoop. And it is obvious, as Ralph said, there are a number of things that need to be done by the world citizens, the nations itself. The UN's got to get in there, and humanitarian organizations have got to, in effect, do all they can, because literally, if left to his own devices, Gaddafi will keep killing people until there's nobody left who wants to oppose him.
And we need to start moving warships into the Mediterranean.
Well, they already have. They've already moved. They've already moved an entire carrier group off the coast of Libya, which is a huge escalation. I mean, this is truly President Obama's first true international, call it aggressive maneuver with the Defense Department. Perry.
And the thing to keep in mind as we talk about that, and it keeps popping up here on CNN, on TV, in the back, is that those ships moving in towards the coast are there on a strictly observation basis. Secretary Gates has said they have absolutely no authority to use any sort of arms or, any aggressive behaviors, that they're there to watch right now. Now, that could change, as of now, they're just watching to see what happens.
Bob, in your experience here in Washington, what would cause the Defense Department to change its stance to go from strictly observational to a more tactical maneuver inside Libya? Does the body count have to increase for us to...
Well, let's assume that we continue to have, in effect, death squads, if you will, mercenaries out there shooting people. I would think that we might very well launch some planes off a carrier and just have them flying over Tripoli and seeing what's going on.
But we're talking about, now we're getting into a slippery slope.
Yeah, we are.
We're talking about violation of national sovereignty and national airspace.
Yes, we are.
Under the Geneva Convention, that's an act of war.
Well, the question would be, who would authorize that? Take, for example, the UN Security Council could very well say, someone's got to do that. I don't think we're going to do it just on our own, and I don't think that Libya is going to be so foolish as to fire a shot at our cruisers out there and our aircraft carrier.
It's going to be up to NATO to enforce a no-fly zone.
Is it NATO's responsibility? We still have not seen the Security Council and the UN come up with any resolution declaring a no-fly zone. We still have not seen any sort of UN sanctions against the movement of shipping in and out of Libya, which is something that a lot of people have expected or would have expected to have happened by now. We still have seen, even the administration has taken a very cautious view of what's going on in Tripoli.
And their excuse was they wanted to ensure that all Americans that were over there were able to safely leave the country. But now is the time for the U.S. to take.
Well, we still have Americans over there. Make no mistake about it. Even the American journalists have been somewhat threatened by what's happening inside Tripoli, and we could get into another possible hostage situation.
But the Obama administration has made it clear the reason they did not come out forcibly against Gaddafi was
because of the hostage situation.
Yeah. Right.
Which makes sense, Perry.
And going back to your point about, who would authorize flying planes in and that type of thing, it's an even slippier slope with that specifically, because what you have to remember is that in the past week, we've already had Libyan aircraft land in other countries whose pilots are defecting and saying that they've been ordered to fire on their own people. So we'd have to make it really clear to the Libyan people, whether it's us or another NATO country, that we're coming in to look and to help you. Don't be scared of the jets flying overhead, or then you get into another PR issue.
Well, I mean, again, we're dealing with a situation here of national sovereignty. Right now, we have not, the UN has not de-recognized the sovereign government of the country of Libya. Until that happens, we have a situation where we're going to be beholden to international law. We just cannot arbitrarily go in and start buying weapons. And I'm hawkish. I say we should take a more aggressive stance, short of full out tactical maneuvers inside the country.
And that means supporting the Libyan opposition movement.
Well, that brings up a whole nother slippery slope of, are we in fact country building, or are we in fact protecting the rights of the Libyan people? Do we have that?
Well, there is a Libyan opposition movement that also has support among countries comprising the UN.
Bob, how do we navigate this slippery slope? How have we done it in the past?
Well, I don't think we've really in recent years ever had a situation like this, so it's hard to say what in the past. But if I were us, I think I'd have the Secretary of State up at the UN Security Council looking for some resolutions to give some authority to anybody who can stop the killing.
Well, we saw UN Ambassador Rice today here at the White House getting a briefing to the President and to the National Security Council just on this subject, and she came out and said that we are going to take a proactive stance when it comes to dealing with the situation in Libya. But the question still stands is, what is that proactive measure? What is that proactive maneuvering that we're going to be able to do? Is it putting pressure on the UN Security Council to come up with some sort of joint resolution to fix the situation, or is it a matter of, do we take it upon ourselves in the matter of national security? This Libya, by all accounts, poses a clear and present danger to the national security of the United States. Would you disagree with that, Bob?
Yes.
You would?
Yes. I don't think it poses a clear and present danger to us.
How so?
Well, we can get oil from someplace else.
Which will bring us up to our next topic in the next segment, so that's fine.
I mean, the only thing you say, there is no way that if Gaddafi decided today to try to attack American interests, what could he do? So, you know,
he has tried to assassinate
American.
Yeah, well, that's not a clear and present danger. That may be something that we need to redress by going in and getting him and trying him. But a clear and present danger means you're able to attack the United States.
Well, I disagree with you on that, Bob. Okay. I think that when we talk about, I mean, look, Iran in 1978, 1979, in the Muslim uprising under Ayatollah Khomeini, when they took hostages at American sovereign soil at the U.S. Embassy, that poses a clear and present danger to the national security of the United States. I would venture to say and argue that says we have a similar possible situation. What is to say that Gaddafi does not get a little bit more crazy? Because let's be honest, the stuff he's saying right now is just totally nuts.
Well, he's pretty far along the path already.
This is Charlie Sheen crazy.
Remember, in 79, I don't think Charlie Sheen is as... I don't think he's as bad as Gaddafi.
Well, Gaddafi is going to start murdering his people on a large scale. We're already seeing
that's where the UN and the NATO together ought to be able to put together some plans. But
to prevent genocide.
Yeah,
that's why
that's important.
Go in.
I mean, that's the most important stuff. But there's nothing that Gaddafi can do that rises to the level of an attack upon the United States itself.
You mean to tell me that invading the U.S. embassy in Tripoli is not a clear and present danger?
No, number one, he hasn't done it.
Do you think it's beyond his capability?
Of course not. Of course not. But the point is, he hasn't done it. Number one. So, in my view of the world, we were talking earlier about, we were even worried a little while ago about having airplanes flying over the place.
Correct.
So the point is, I think it's even more struggle if we start sending troops into, we start landing 500 Marines surround our embassy. I don't think that's a good plan we could do.
What?
But the fact of the matter is, between the UN Security Council and NATO, the two of them decide that he's become a danger to beyond his borders or to his own people to the extent that he is absolutely prepared to kill anybody who gets in his way, I would think that there will probably be some kind of an action against the government Libya as seen in the person of Gaddafi.
And we're starting to see it on the diplomatic front.
Sure. Yeah, they're pushing.
Well, you know, when we talk about the diplomatic front, the one organization that we've not seen really show its power in the region is the Organization of Arab States.
Yeah.
We have not seen the Arab community under that organization, or even in the UN, arguably, truly rise up and saying, look, this is a regional issue that is causing instability and could be a danger to all sovereign governments around Libya.
Well, they have their own issues with their own people to deal with.
And they're
very afraid of Gaddafi. I mean, he still commands a lot of fear among people.
Well, we're coming at quarter past the hour here in the East Coast, quarter past the hour out in the West Coast, and we're going to take a 2-minute break here. If you'd like to join us again, the number is 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Talking about, from the last segment, the situation going on in the Middle East, particularly the situation out in Libya. It's caused great discussion, but it's definitely a situation that's going to have domestic ramifications. Number one, the whole situation in the Middle East has caused a huge spike in oil futures. We saw oil go up as high as $102, $103 a barrel. It's since come back down into double digits, but it kind of hovers in that 97, 98 to 100, 102. That's going to cause everybody's oil to go up. The question is, obviously, there is a tremendous, tremendous impact, which I'm going to say, I'll come out and say it, is media-driven, that what happens in the Middle East directly affects what happens in our oil futures. I will tell you right now, until the media starts talking about the fact that we get more oil from Canada, we get more oil from Mexico, we get more oil from Brazil than we do from all the OPEC nations combined, that what happens in the Middle East should not be affecting oil futures. Until that happens, we're going to continue to be paying. What did you pay today, Bob?
I paid $3.71.
$3.71 a gallon. Right. We're getting dangerously close.
10 days ago it was about $3.30.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the media rhetoric going on about what's happening in the Middle East, and that continues to have people go and buy. I mean, when we talk about $100 a barrel, we're talking about oil futures. They're banking on the fact that oil is going to be hugely expensive down the road. We're not talking about the current production capability that we have that you put into your gas tank. Bob?
I just noticed on the market dropped, was down some 160 points.
Wow.
So that tells you today that's a big drop. That's 2 days in a row that we've had major drops.
And you have to worry that if Gaddafi, in an act of desperation, burns the oil fields in Libya, what that would do to the stock market.
But again, you know, it is something that the American electorate and the American public is beholden to the 24-hour news cycle. They see pictures of instability in the Middle East. The bottom line is, it doesn't really directly affect our oil imports. It certainly doesn't affect what we're importing from Canada. That's going to continue. It's certainly not going to affect what happens when we bring in oil from Mexico.
No.
That's going to continue to happen. Why are we so beholden and why are we so dependent on what the media tells us is happening in the Middle East? Bob?
Well, thanks a lot. I always like easy questions. But the fact of the matter is,
by the way, I'm getting some really good stares from some people here in the audience here at Sully's back room.
Well, what am I to replace you?
Low blow.
Harsh,
Bob.
We're supposed to promote civility.
Yeah. Civility. Yeah. Well, the problem is that the oil market, you know, oil is fungible. Oil is oil. It's basically the same. And so the world market is one market. It isn't just our market, even though we get most of our oil from very friendly sources. The fact of the matter is, a significant bit of it does come out of the Middle East. And to the extent that that looks like it could be impacted directly, it scares people. It gets the markets nervous. When the stock market went down almost 170 points today. Now, that's a significant drop. And I can't imagine anything except the concern over the oil market in the Middle East and what's happening in Libya probably is almost the sole cause of that.
But again, you know, I go back to the fact that our number one source of oil in this country is our best ally in Canada.
Sure it is.
We're still going to produce oil from Canadian oil. We're still going to produce gasoline, natural gas from those sources. And on top of the fact, we're still finding pockets of petroleum reserves that could sustain us for decades down the road. But yet we see what's happening in the Middle East, and that just drives oil futures nuts. Is that part of the problem of a globalized market economy, Ralph? I'm asking you the tough question. Just call me Chris Matthews.
You're better looking.
Wow, that's awesome. Thank you. That's the nicest thing you've said to me, Bob.
Well, obviously the Middle East gets a lot of publicity for many issues, not just dealing with the oil, but political, religious, social. And American mindset is on what's happening in the Middle East. Obviously, they need our show to educate them about the fact that Canada is where we receive most of our oil from. People are not reading. They're just listening to the news.
They listen to the news. They see the sound bites, and they immediately react to sound bites as opposed to – and that's one of the stanchions of the First Congress Society is we talk about, hey, people, investigate the issues. Don't just feed off the sound bites. Get involved. Find out where exactly do we get our oil? Where exactly is the production coming from? I think once America gets back to a point where we're not beholden to a TV screen, we'll probably see a lot of this instability in the oil market subside. Am I wrong in this, Bob?
I don't think so.
Ralph?
I don't think so at all.
So, for those of you who are interested, please join First Congress Society. Go to www.firstcongress.org. And join the effort. Become educated. Become involved. But this is just one subject that has domestic implications based on what we're seeing on a TV screen happening in Tripoli. But other than that, we talk about the economic impacts. I mean, obviously, Ralph, your contacts in China have to be obviously very concerned because they've now become the number two oil consumer country in the world. How's this going to affect their economy?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Libya was a place where the Chinese were doing a substantial amount of business. They've had to focus on getting their people out of a rather tumultuous situation. And now, hopefully they're going to come on board with the U.S. and the rest of the members of the Security Council and impose tough sanctions on Gaddafi to force them out of power.
Ralph, doesn't China get a good bit more as a percentage of their oil from Libya than we do?
Libya and Iran.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this has
and it's purely an economic reason.
So this has direct implications on the Chinese economy, which, as everybody's seen in the media of recent, it has direct implications on our economy here in the U.S.
Right. Chinese bought more cars than any other group of people in the world last year.
Really?
Yes. More cars are being sold in China than anywhere else in the world.
And this is a country that thrives on bikes.
They were so poor they could barely afford to buy a bicycle. Now look where they are. They are number two behind the U.S. and growing.
Wow.
I saw a number recently when there was an article about General Motors and their recovery, and it said that General Motors sold more cars in China last year than in the United States.
I believe that's
disturbing. There's
a car culture evolving in China because for the first time, the people have disposable income and they're being encouraged to travel and explore their own country for the first time. And the way they do that is by buying a car.
And the cars they're buying are obviously big, fat Cadillacs that they make in Detroit. Perry.
Wait, so Ralph, they don't use those high-speed rail lines to get all over the place?
They're doing that,
too.
Okay. Hey.
I got to tell you.
They have a billion people. All modes of transportation.
There's very few parts of conversation that you can respond with. They have a billion people and the conversation there.
And by the way, the developing the story out of Libya continues to be the humanitarian crisis going on the Tunisian Libyan border.
Well, we have to look at what Russia is going to do. They have had a very close relationship with the Gaddafi regime for over 30 years. In fact, Gaddafi's legal advisor studied at Moscow State University and has very close ties with people in the government there.
Does President Medvedev have a direct issue with possibly, having a smooth transition or a peaceful transition of Gaddafi out? Does he have a voice with Muammar Gaddafi, or is it just...
They could play a very constructive role, but again, they're concerned about their economic interests and would they lose clout in Libya if Gaddafi leaves?
Well,
how would that affect their economic relationships?
We're looking here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics. We have CNN up on the big screen here by our radio studio, and they're now putting up headlines of chaos plaguing the Libyan border. The humanitarian crisis is got to be something of a focal point right now. Ralph, when we talk about the humanitarian crisis, going on. I mean, you're going from one seriously unstable country in Libya to a somewhat unstable country in Tunisia. The ripple effect going into places like Morocco, the whole northern Africa Horn, it's a domino effect.
Absolutely. Just look at Oman. People have been demonstrating for 3 days now. And what this has resulted in, the government ordering 50,000 new state positions and a monthly stipend of $390 for people that are unemployed and looking for work. So they're taking positive steps to deal with the issues being raised by their people.
Let me ask this question then, Ralph. In your experience, I mean, you know, we've heard, you know, the Iranian people, you know, especially the younger generation in Iran, are truly pro-American. They love the American culture. They love the American lifestyle. That they're pushing for a more democratic, more American voice in what they do. We've also heard similar situations coming out of Bahrain. Egypt, in particular, was a younger crowd spawned by the bloggings of a Google executive who was still in his early 30s. Are we going to see more of a transition to an Americanized form of government in this part of the world, or are we still going to see the truly solid positioning of organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, for example?
I think you're going to see younger people pushing for transparency and accountability, jobs, economic reforms. And one of the issues in Egypt that people don't talk about was the repeal of the anti-terrorism law, similar to our Patriot Act in this country. This newer generation now has access to new media. They are very concerned about the relationship of the older generation being very tied into corruption and lack of transparency. They're not willing to adopt a Muslim Brotherhood because that's moving more towards a radical Islamic fundamentalism. So they kind of want a middle ground where they want transparency, accountability, some democratic reforms that the West offers, but at the same time, they don't want to throw off Islam.
Well, this begs the question then, Ralph, is when we look at what's happening, you know, there are those on the far right here in the United States that have said, hey, what's happening there is just going to be an insurgency of radical Islamic behavior. Is that a reality, or is that just political rhetoric?
It could be a reality. I mean, there have been revolutions that have sort of turned on themselves. The key is going to be how the United States and other countries help these people. Are they going to provide support and guidance on both an economic, political, moral standpoint, or are they just going to sit back and see how this evolves? I think the U.S. has to sort of take a direct role in working with these people that are clamoring for a form of Western-style reform and democracy.
Can that yearning for American-style governance offset the Islamic radicalization?
I think so, if it's done in the right way, as long as we're not perceived as meddling or interfering. But
there's a thin line there, Ralph.
That is. That we have to be sort of a mentor, a friend, where we can guide them, but they ultimately it's up to the Egyptian, the Libyan, the Omani people to chart their own future.
What organizations here in the federal government could help promote that? I mean, are we talking about organizations like USAID, the Agency for International Development, or USTDA, the U.S. Trade and Development Agency? Are those the organizations that truly need to be engaged and involved?
All
here?
Of those organizations, NGOs, Voice of America, and setting a positive business framework and relationships. It's the people that are doing business in those countries that really become role models and ambassadors for the next generation.
Bob, in your years of Congress, you know, we've seen members of Congress take stands on international affairs and critical situations such as what we're seeing in the Middle East right now. Is there a precedence for Congress to truly move forward and help drive the administration into how they should approach the situation in Libya?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time something like that happened, but I think I tend to agree with Ralph. We have to be very careful that we do not seem to be sticking our nose too closely into the decision-making process. I think resolutions of support for freedom and right of expression and independence and, you know, is fine. But we have to be very careful what we do. I think there, to add to what Ralph was saying, there's a lot of NGOs, you know, independent organizations and bodies and conferences that exist that could be helpful here, you know, in the Western world, if asked to come in by the Libyans to help them to find, you know, how to put their constitution together, how to draft their laws protecting the rights of citizens or building their judiciary system. There are a whole lot of bodies in the Western world that can be useful and are not part of the government structure of the West. They're independent. And I think probably organizations like that can be almost more positively helpful than can any of the governments of the West.
Right. We're coming into the last couple of minutes of this segment, and we're going to take a break here. But in the last couple of minutes, Ralph, in your experience in international affairs, how do you see what's happening in Libya and what's happening in the Middle East? How do you see it playing out down in the future? Does it benefit the American government? Does it benefit the global community? Or are we truly getting into in making the Middle East more unstable?
Well, here's an interesting point. The South Koreans are now dropping pamphlets in North Korea about explaining what's happening in the Middle East with the unrest. You're going to see a rippling effect in a lot of different countries.
Including the Far East?
Including the Far East.
Wow. Big news. Bob, yeah. How do you see this playing out?
My feeling is that unless, you know, the chances are that when all the unrest of the Middle East comes to an end and different countries are restructuring themselves, we are going to see what comes out of that. I think long term is going to be better for peace in the world and stability in the Middle East and engagement by the rest of the world in the Middle East, all together, working together. It's going to be better than it has been in the past because we're going to be removing some of the problems of these autocratic leadership that have not helped the people. They go, it'll be better.
Good. Great discussion on the subject. When we come back, we're going to get into a less serious note. We're going to talk about what's happening in the 2012 presidential election. A big name came out and said they were going to support for it. First one to God. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Talk, live from Shelley's Backroom on Paul Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Ha ha ha!
room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room. And we're here. We've got a nice little audience here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics. Joining me, as always, Bob Hines, getting resettled in after a little break. Dr. Ralph Winnie is out doing Dr. Ralph Winnie-type stuff. And our executive producer, Perry Blasting, just back from feeding the meter and promoting civil government here in the nation's capital. We had a good discussion last segment on Libya, but we're going to turn the table a little bit now, talk about the 2012 election. News out of Washington, D.C. today is, and this is probably not a huge surprise to anybody inside politics, is Newt Gingrich has officially formed an exploratory committee for his 2012 presidential campaign. Ralph Winnie joining us again, getting resettled in. Bob, this is obviously the worst-kept secret in politics inside the Beltway today.
It's the worst-kept secret. I think the only question was which day of the week he was going to choose to make his announcement.
Let me ask this question. When we talk about Newt Gingrich, I mean, he's the first one out of a pretty lengthy list of Republicans that are considering running in 2012. The most notable name absent from that list is Governor Chris Christie, who's gotten a lot of TVQ of late. But Newt Gingrich, we had long anticipated him making a move from this. Bob, the solid question comes out is, how real is this campaign, and does he have a chance?
Well, at least he is indicating he intends to seek the nomination, so as of this point, he's got all the votes because he's the only one in. But I would think that the fact once somebody steps up to the plate and says, I am going to form an exploratory committee, that tends to start everybody else to get, you know, a little bit more decision-making close. They have to hurry up. They don't want him to be out there, let's say, for 2 or 3 months alone, you know, developing resources in the way of funding, developing resources in the way of getting people to commit to him. So nobody wants him to get too big a lead. So there's going to be, I think, in the next 6 weeks, you're going to see several more people be popping up.
Ralph, how's Newt Gingrich viewed internationally? I mean, you know, he's a known figure. I mean, you can't turn on a talking head show in this town without seeing Newt at least once a week. How's he viewed internationally? Is he a credible force in American politics?
Well, he's perceived as a neocon. I think he still has a lot of high negatives both here and abroad. I think one of the things he's done very successfully, though, is setting up American Solutions. And they put forth some very good ideas and proposals on how to move the country forward. Newt has an international background. I think his father was in the military. He traveled. He's been going on a lot of exploratory trips to China and Russia through the American Foreign Policy Council.
Right.
And that's going to serve him in good stead.
Now, when we look at Newt Gingrich and his position, you know, it's ironic that the news, quote unquote, breaks the same day that Congress is voting on the government shutdown. It's ironic. It was Speaker Gingrich that was in the chair when they last voted for a government shutdown. Is that irony being wasted on just political pundits, or do you think Americans have a long-term memory of that?
No, I don't think they do. Some people will try to remind other people of that, but I don't think that particular issue is a problem for him. I mean, that happened 15 years ago.
Right.
And I think that probably that's water over the dam. I don't think that he is going to be particularly pressed on that issue. As Ralph says, he is a font of ideas. He's got many ideas. Some are good, some are bad, but he's a thinking man. He's a very bright man. He's a very energetic fellow. He'll be a serious candidate.
There is no question that Newt Gingrich is, in fact, a man of political theory. He is a great, great thinker in the realm of political strategy and American history. He's definitely one that's been pushing the, you know, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. And quite frankly, his novels aren't too bad to read either. I don't know if this is what you read, any of his historical stuff. It's not bad. I got to tell you something. I mean, it's not going to be New York Times bestseller, but it's not a bad read. I got to tell you something. You download it on your Kindle. Take a look at it.
And putting together that video documentary on the Pope and Ronald Reagan and Thatcher, I think, is going to hold him in good stead with conservatives.
Ah, there we go. There we go. Who's in the batter's box next, Bob? Who do you think might be coming out? I mean, we've seen some people officially drop out. We mentioned Chris Christie. I mean, literally had to go up in the State House and say, what do you want me to do, commit suicide to convince you I'm not running for 2012? But, you know, we've also seen Senator John Thune pull out. We've seen some notable names that we thought might be in play come out. Who do you think is next in the batter's box? Who do you think might come out of the box next?
Well, the person who probably has the best structure right now in the field of potentials is Mitt Romney. He has got he's been more places, he's raised more money, he's got more support in a variety of states, he's been to Iowa several times. I would believe he would not wait too much longer now that someone else has jumped into the race or begins to jump into the race. I think that Romney will probably not wait too long to indicate his interest.
I mean, is it going to be a race between him and somebody like a Tim Pawlenty that might be in play?
I think Pawlenty will probably have to move too, and he needs to catch up. Now, as an example, Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, both of them have more national structure, if you will, than Pawlenty does.
Right.
So if Pawlenty is serious, he can't wait. He's got to get started before all the good advisors and all the good money people and all the good organizers in the various early primary states are already committed to one candidate or another. You know, there's a lot of people who are potentials, but that doesn't mean just because there are a dozen people who might want to jump in, doesn't mean that there are enough good money raisers, good organizers, good counselors to take care of a dozen people.
Well, I mean, we're literally dealing with a presidential cycle that is, we're almost 2 years, I mean, we're just shy of 2 years from the next presidential election in November 2012. The fact that Newt Gingrich is announcing, the fact that Mitt Romney is announcing, I mean, is this just play into the problem of the eternal election cycle, Bob?
Well, yeah, it does, but the fact of the matter is, this is not a particularly early start. How many articles have we all seen in the last 2 or 3 months saying who's gonna jump in? There's a whole lot of people who are walking around the musical chairs, but nobody sits down and says, I'm going to do it. So I don't think it's particularly early. As a matter of fact, it's a little bit late as far as I would think, particularly since there is no obvious strong candidate. It means all the more that you've got to get out there and start working so people get to know you. There's probably nobody, with the maybe exception of Sarah Palin, who everybody knows.
True. And by the way, Sarah Palin has come out and said theoretically she will not run. But do you buy that? Do you buy that, Bob?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Ralph, do you buy that?
I do. I think she's got a lot of bad publicity off of her reality show. It's made her look really foolish.
I think that she will have an impact on the nomination because, love her or hate her, there are a number of people who love her, and if she says that Joe Smith is the one, that will encourage some people to be for Joe Smith.
Wow.
Because she does have a following, a significant following within the party. It's not a majority, but it's a significant group, and it's a very loyal group.
The one hang-up I think Gingrich has, it goes back to his first two marriages, and they both ended in a very rocky fashion. The first marriage was to a much older woman at the time, and when she was in the hospital, he came and told her he was getting a divorce. I think she had cancer.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the second marriage to Marianne ended in a very, very bitter divorce.
You think the Party of Family Values is going to call him the question on that? Do you think the media jumps on it?
Right, and he was having an affair with Marianne when he was still the Speaker.
Well,
the social conservatives are going to I don't think they've forgiven him for those.
Well, I mean, that then begs the question. It's a position that we've taken in the First Congress Society, the three of us as originating members of the organization, is that, you know, the media's deep dived into his personal life. Look, what Newt has done, nothing illegal.
Right.
Newt has done nothing, quote-unquote, unethical that would bring him up on charges inside the Ethics Committee, inside the House, or any political organization. Does his personal life is his? Are we really deep diving again into a subject that really has no bearing on his ability to govern?
Except, you remember the Monica Lewinsky scandal. That was all happening at that time. And he looked to be a hypocrite coming out of that. Now, he's worked very hard to rehabilitate his image. And I think he has, for the most part. But still, there are social conservatives that have not forgiven him for his marital indiscretion.
Bob, what do you think?
Well, he's got some baggage. You must remember, he was, I believe, what's the right word? He was reprimanded.
Right.
He was reprimanded by the House of Representatives. I can't remember the exact details of the event, but I know he was reprimanded, which is probably more. It's maybe a more serious question long term than his number of marriages, although. I know that the way some of his marriages ended and the way he acted was ways that I suspect a number of women will not find very appealing, and people will talk about it. But he's going to be a serious candidate. He is very bright. He is extremely quick. He has ideas that are sometimes very, very creative and very, very good solutions. He's bright. He's articulate. He'll be a good candidate. He'll be someone to deal with.
Okay.
He'll be a very good debater against Obama.
He'll be an excellent debater against anybody he debates.
Right.
He is really good at that.
He is a fantastic orator. There's no question about it. We're last 5 minutes of the show, folks. We go into our free form, our section of the discussion of, I like to call, Tell Me a Story. And traditionally, Bob's usually come out as a winner. He's always got the good intel. Bob has now scooped Politico several times on several instances where we've been reading about it either the next day or a couple of days later. So we're going to start, though, with Ralph. Ralph, tell me a story.
In Chicago, Rahm Emanuel is going to be taking on the cops, the firefighters, the unions in the coming year.
Really?
So stay tuned. We'll see you. This
should
really? Be very interesting.
Why would he do that?
Well, the same issues like in Wisconsin with the budget.
Wow. Going head to head with the people who put him in office.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's be honest. The FOP PBA and the International Association of Firefighters helped get Rahm elected.
Well, remind yourself though, those are the very unions that tend to be more conservative than the other unions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is probably why I'm a big fan of them too.
Yeah, there you go.
Bob, tell me a story. Let's scoop the media again.
Well, I don't know that I can do that, but I'll say this. My guess is, and we were just talking about who was going to be running. My guess is that the fact that Mr. Gingrich has now jumped in means to me that well before the end of March, first of March. Well before the end of this month, we'll have other candidates in.
Really?
Yes.
Including Romney?
I think so.
Including Plenty?
I'm not sure. But
really?
I would suspect that those two gentlemen may very well be the two who would jump in.
In the Republican Party for 2012, who's the big dark horse?
They're all pretty dark, except for, you know, Gingrich and Romney probably are the two that have the most visible image and the brightest image, along with Palin, who I don't think is going to run, but most of the other candidates are people who have good records but are not well known.
Right.
So I think you have to get in fairly early anyway if you're not well known, and the fact that we've already had a major candidate jump indicate that he is going to jump in, I think means that we're going to have some more. I think the dominoes are going to begin to fall well before the end of the month.
The big dark horse is going to be John Huntsman.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I think a lot of people, I don't know that, I think that's been discussed.
Well, that's the dark horse. Yeah.
That would be a true dark.
Right.
Perry, tell me a story.
So, you know, you mentioned that Bob has a history of, you know, that inside information that's been scooping Politico. I apparently have a history of reporting information that nobody else is ever going to report. So in keeping with that tradition and this discussion of the Republican nominee for 2012, due to his recent media blitz, I think that in the next week to two, we're going to see Charlie Sheen announced.
I gotta tell you something, man. I'm gonna say that man is just plum nuts. That man is just a total head case.
He's a winner.
He's a rock star from Mars. Seriously, kid? Man, I mean, at some point, Bob, you even made the point earlier. Yeah. What was the comment you said earlier?
I said
amongst others about Charlie Sheen.
Well, the first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. And he seems to have a real big shovel.
we had a member of the audience today come up and say they were showing Piers Morgan. Apparently, is going to have an exclusive with Charlie Sheen. Apparently, it's his eighth exclusive interview today.
He's been on everything.
This guy's everywhere. Yeah. At what point do we stop watching the train wreck? That's my question. I mean, in all seriousness, he's obviously got some demons he's got to deal with. We wish him all the best. There's no question the man's a talented actor, but, dude, you got to come back to reality.
It's spiraling downhill.
It's definitely a tailspin here. Last minute, we just want to invite everybody, please, check out the First Congress Society website, www.firstcongress.org. Get active, get involved, stay on top of the issues that affect you directly and even sometimes indirectly in the way that government governs your lives. On behalf of Dr. Ralph Winnie, Bob Hines, Perry Blasting, and our missing comrade at arms in some nice place in Mexico, Al Swift, I'm JT Russell. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next Tuesday at 4 o'clock here on Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you. Have a great day.
This is the place to be.